It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest this hour is Gene Bishop. Bishop is a criminal defense attorney and an activist working for restorative justice, which emphasizes repairing the harm caused by criminal behavior. In 1990, Gene Bishop's sister, Nancy, and brother-in-law, Richard, were murdered at their home in an affluent Chicago suburb, Winnetka. A long investigation led to the conviction of a local high school student. He was sentenced as a juvenile to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Bishop now visits him in prison regularly. She is the author of Change of Heart, Justice, Mercy, and Making Peace with My Sister's Killer. Bishop is in Iowa speaking this week at Drake University's Legal Clinic. She joins me from the Des Moines studio of Iowa Public Radio. Gene Bishop, welcome to our program.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
It's been a long time, but my condolences. I'm very sorry for your loss. I'm sure it's with you every day.
Thank you so much for saying so.
Can you take us back? This is recounted in your book, to the night that your sister, Nancy, and Richard, your brother-in-law, were killed in 1990.
Yes, it was the happiest evening of our lives just about as a family because we were all out to dinner celebrating what would have been the first grandchild from my parents and my first little niece or nephew. Nancy was my younger sister. She was the youngest of us three girls. I have an older sister and I'm the middle child. And we were celebrating Nancy's announcement that they were going to have their first child. She was 3 months pregnant.
Mm. And you had been out to dinner with them in Winnetka?
Actually, in the city of Chicago, and then we all hugged goodnight in the parking lot. I went back to my apartment in the city. My parents went to their big home in the suburbs. And when Nancy and Richard went back to their townhouse in Winnetka, the killer was waiting for them.
You found out about it when, the next day?
The next day, I was standing at the back of my church. I sing in a choir in this big Presbyterian church downtown in Chicago, and the church secretary came to me and said, "You have a phone call."
Mm-hmm.
And it was my father calling to tell me that Nancy and Richard had been found shot to death in the basement of their townhouse.
Was it your father who had discovered them, right?
It was. He went over after the next day was, it was Palm Sunday the next day after we had been out to dinner. And after church, he went over to their home. And when they didn't answer the doorbell, he thought something was just odd. And so he had a key to their townhouse. And when he opened the door, he saw broken glass from the sliding glass door in the back and the light on in the basement. And when he looked down, there was Nancy and Richard lying there frozen in death.
Hmm. Tell us about what did investigators have when they started with this killing?
They had almost nothing. I mean, this was a happy young couple, no enemies, no reason in the world anyone should want to execute them. I mean, my brother-in-law was shot in the back of the head once, execution style. Nancy was shot twice in her pregnant stomach and left to bleed to death. And so there were all these wild theories that circulated. For 6 months, no one knew who had done it. And then one day I got a phone call from a reporter asking my reaction about the arrest in my sister's murder. And I said, "What arrest?" And he said, "There's a teenager in custody in the Winnetka police station."
Mm. And who is that teenager?
The teenager was a young man named David Bureau. He lived three blocks away from Nancy and Richard. And he had used the glass cutter to break in. Had stolen a .357 Magnum revolver that he used to kill them. They found that glass cutter and that revolver with a perfect match to the ballistics of the bullets in my sister's body under his bed, in his bedroom, in his home when they got a search warrant.
Mm-hmm. What was his motivation?
We didn't know for a long time because when he went to trial, he took the stand and tried to blame it on someone else. And so for years until I reached out to him, I didn't know why, because he had consistently denied committing the crime. But when I finally did meet with him in prison, he explained that it really was a burglary gone bad, that he had gone into the townhouse and thought that he would wait for them to come home and steal their cars and their wallets in addition to whatever was there in the house. He thought better of it when they walked through the front door and tried to go out the side door of the kitchen. Mm-hmm. But that door was locked from the inside and there was no key in it. And when he said that, I just gasped because that is a detail he could not have made up and could not have known unless it was true. because I've been in that townhouse and I know that that is true. Without a key in the kitchen door, you can't get out from the inside. And he said that when he saw them and they saw him, he just felt he had to finish it.
What was the evidence during the trial that convicted him? What was the most compelling evidence?
Oh, there was a mountain of evidence. I mean, first of all, there was the confession that led for him to be turned in. He had bragged about the killing to a number of his friends, but they kind of sat on that information. They didn't want to turn him in and see him get in trouble. Finally, one of his friends, his kind of conscience got the better of him. And so the murder happened in April. The confession happened around June. And finally, in October, this young man, also a junior in high school, turned in David Biro to the authorities.
Mm-hmm. You said it was so many months went by when no one knew who did it. It was really a puzzle, a mystery. What were your initial thoughts when you found it out at a juvenile, a 17-year-old, a junior, had been arrested?
16-year-old. He was 1 month short of his 17th birthday. I was astounded. I mean, my brother-in-law was a high school athlete in football, baseball, and basketball. He's 6'3", 230 pounds. And my younger sister, Nancy, is a big, strong woman like I am. And I just imagine that it would have taken maybe 2 men to overpower them and to find out that it was the skinny 16-year-old boy. But then I realized all he needed to overpower them was that gun. All he had to do was pointed at them, and they were helpless.
Even though when he was a juvenile, who at the time he committed these murders, he was sentenced to life in prison. Tell us about the sentence.
Right. So back then in 1990, the United States still allowed U.S. states to have a death penalty for juveniles. So you could be a child who committed a crime and be executed for that crime in states that had the death penalty, like Oklahoma, Texas, and Florida. Illinois did not have a death penalty for juveniles at the time. And since then, in a case called Roper versus Simmons, the U.S. Supreme Court has actually abolished the death penalty for juveniles. But back then, if you were a 16-year-old boy who killed 2 people, you could get the death penalty in other states. In Illinois, we didn't have that. What we had is a mandatory sentence if you kill more than one person in the same episode of life in prison without the possibility of parole. And what that means is that you go to prison and you die there. There's no ever second look at you. There's no parole hearing where we decide, you know, have you been good in prison? Can we let you out safely now? That does not exist. You would go into prison and come out in a coffin.
If you just joined us, Jean Bishop is my guest. She's a criminal defense attorney and activist, author of Change of Heart, Justice, Mercy, and Making Peace with My Sister's Killer, a book she's put out. She's in Iowa speaking at Drake University. I'll ask you about that a little bit later, but take us back to the end of this trial, the sentencing to life in prison of this young man, David Biro, without the possibility of parole. What were your thoughts then? Was there a sense or a hope that there would be closure and the beginning of healing of some sort?
That's a great question. And first, I'm going to start with the closure part. I think knew from the instant I found out that my sister and her brother-in-law and baby were dead that there's no such thing as closure, that every Christmas, every birthday, every holiday, when there's an empty seat at the table, I will always miss her. That ache will always be there. And that love for her will always be there, accompanied by that grief. And so I don't want to close that, even if I could. And no sentence of what happened to him would ever close that. What I wanted, though, was justice. And I did, you know, feel at the time that if you take 3 human lives, that it's just for the rest of your life to be spent in prison. And so when he was taken from the courtroom after he was given that sentence into the lockup, my mother turned to me and said, "We'll never see him again." And at the time, I was glad of that and I supported that. But since then, I had a complete change of heart about that sentence.
Mm-hmm. Where was the pivot point, the turning point about that sentence?
Well, it started with kind of the people who are my North Star of morality and justice. Sister Helen Prejean, the Catholic nun who, you know, opposes the death penalty. She's the author of Dead Men Walking. Andrea Lyon, who is the hero. She's called the Angel of Death Row because in 19 cases in the state of Illinois, she has never lost one. She's never had a client sentenced to death. Other people that I admire very much, Mark Osler, a former prosecutor who's a law professor and opposes the death penalty based on his Christian faith, and opposes also juvenile life sentences because he feels that it, you know, wrongly condemns people who were children when they committed their crimes to, you know, to dying in prison. And I thought, you know, are they right? Am I wrong? And so that was kind of the first part. The second part was having a kind of a change of heart about the sentence itself. I started realizing that what I was advocating for against the death penalty was mercy, and that a life without parole sentence for a juvenile is a merciless sentence because it tells a young person, no matter how sorry you are, no matter how rehabilitated, how remorseful, we are going to lock you away forever. And I felt that, you know, since I was capable of growth and change, every human being is capable of that. And I wouldn't want that sentence for my own child. And if I don't want that for my own child, then I can't want it for anyone else's child.
Mm-hmm. And at one point, you took the step of writing a letter to David in a maximum security prison. What prompted that specific action?
Well, actually, it was Mark Osler who I mentioned. So what happened along the way was in the year 2012, the U.S. Supreme Court again did a kind of a groundbreaking decision with respect to juveniles and said that juveniles can't be given a mandatory sentence of life without parole. In other words, you can still give a juvenile a life sentence, but there has to be discretion. The judge has to be able to look at all these different factors, like how did you grow up? Was there any trauma? Was there any mental illness, you know, compulsion, that kind of thing, and before doing a life sentence. And so, you know, that meant that David Bureau was entitled to a resentencing on this mandatory sentence he'd gotten. And so I said to Mark Osler, you know, I don't know. I mean, I've forgiven him, you know, in my own mind and heart. I'm not, you know, seeking vengeance and bitterness against him. But I don't know how about I feel about him getting out someday. I mean, he's still remorseless.
Mm-hmm.
And Mark said, how do you know that? He said, you don't know that. You've never even spoken to him. And I thought, wow, that's true. I mean, I'd forgiven him. I never told him because I figured he hadn't asked for it.
You'd never even thought about that as a possibility.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so I realized I needed to write to him. And so I wrote this very short letter. It's reprinted in its entirety in my book. And it just says, I forgave you a long time ago. And I told the whole world, except the most important person of all, you. And I'm sorry. That was wrong. And I've waited all these years for you to apologize to me. I'm going to go first. I'm sorry. And if you want me to come and see you, I will.
So it was a very brief letter, it sounds like.
Yeah. Yeah. And I had no idea how he'd respond. You know, he could crumple it up and throw it in the wastebasket. He could show it to his cellmate and laugh. He could write me back some, you know, manipulative, you know, letter.
Mm-hmm.
None of that happened. I got back a 15-page letter from him front and back. And the first thing he said in that letter is, I know you've waited so long to hear this. I won't make you wait any longer. I did kill your sister and her husband. And I'm so sorry. If I could take it back, I would.
And he had never confessed to that degree during the trial?
Never. Oh, no, denied it during the trial and never confessed since. And of course, you know, urged by his defense lawyers and everyone else not to confess and, you know, had appeals pending and, you know, didn't. And, you know, when he did confess to me, he actually said that. You realize I've given you something that I can never take back. You have my handwritten confession in writing. Now, you'd think that the people around him in the prison, his fellow prisoners, would say, you know, good for you. I mean, that's, you know, great. You've given some peace to this family, because it was a great solace to us to hear that I'm sorry mm-hmm. from him and that acknowledgement of guilt. And instead, the prisoners around him derided him as a fool. How could you do that? Now you can't deny the crime anymore because he got nothing in return. And that's why it means all the more to me that he sincerely did that out of his sorrow and regret.
And 15 pages he wrote to you. What else was in that letter? Must have been quite a bit of detail about something.
Oh, yeah. It was his whole trajectory of his change of heart, how he went from trying to deny the crime basically because he was looking at life. He said, if I'd been offered, you know, 20 years, 40 years, I would have pled guilty. But when you're telling me, you know, I'm never going to get out the rest of my life, that's why he denied it. But then he got to prison. He'd see things on TV, like a heinous crime where a baby was slaughtered or something. And he'd think, oh, the person who did that was an animal. And then he said, but wait, that's me. I mean, I did something that heinous. I shot a pregnant woman in the stomach. He said that he started visiting with this woman came to visit him and befriended him, and then she just vanished from his life, no explanation. And he just wanted to know why, like why? And he started having empathy for my family, saying, I bet the Bishop family wants to know why, you know, why yeah. I yeah. killed their loved one. Hmm. And then he grew from being a 16-year-old boy to a 42-year-old man who had read and reflected and thought, looked at the people around him and knew he did not want to be that person. He wanted to be a better person. And so he didn't want to reach out to me because he was scared that would traumatize me if I, you know, got a letter unbidden from him with his name and the return address. And so the minute I wrote to him, he started writing back to me.
And so you learned in the meantime that your letter was a tremendous relief to him some way.
It was the opening of a door that had been closed to him for so long in his own mind.
You went, let me remind our listeners, Jean Bishop is my guest, author of Change of Heart, Justice, Mercy, and Making Peace with My Sister's Killer. Jean's sister, Nancy, and her brother-in-law, Richard, were killed, murdered in 1990 in Winnetka, a suburb of Chicago. Jean, you then exchanged letters for a while and finally decided you wanted to meet David Biro, the murderer here.
I did, yeah. Yeah, and I remember that first drive down I-55, the 2.5 hours or so to Pontiac Prison. And the first thing that you do is you sign in this guardhouse. And you put your, you know, name and your address and date of birth and your license plate number and so on. But the last box you fill out on that sheet of paper is visitor's relationship to offender. And I just stood there paralyzed, like, what do I say? Because until that moment, I would have said murderer of my family and murderer's, you know, sister and sister-in-law. And I knew that now this was going to be transformed, that I was going to meet him as a human being, and I was going to shake the hand that held that gun.
And you met him in the same room? Was there a dividing wall or anything?
What happens is you meet face-to-face and have the opportunity to greet each other, and then you're taken to this, you know, pane of glass that separates you. You're on either side, and you're speaking on literally in a hole through the glass. But if you're like the mother of a son and you want to hug them, you can hug them. And I thought, well, what do I do when I first, you know, meet him? And I thought, well, what do you do when you first meet anyone? You shake their hand. And so I did. I took his hand. And it was so moving to see him walk through that door and look at me, because he kind of flushed. And I thought, this is a man and not a monster. I had turned him into this mythical, you know, horrible human being that might come in the night and kill my children. And I had, you know, inflated him into this monster when instead he was this human.
What were your first words to him, to each other?
I said, hello, I'm Jean Bishop. I introduced myself.
And what did he say?
You know what? I can't remember. Mm. I think he must have said, I'm David. And then, you know, we instantly were taken, you know, to the other side. And I went down there not with any agenda. People asked me, you know, did you go in there saying, okay, now why? Why did you do this? And I didn't. I think I was even more interested in the trajectory of how you go from being this child who grew up in this town that I grew up in to being a 16-year-old who puts a gun to the back of a grown man's head and pulls the trigger. But after a while, I started to realize that he had to tell me his story of April 7th, 1990, and, you know, which included, you know, the why of what had happened.
Mm-hmm. How did, in those later conversations of the adult David Biro, how did he talk about himself as a 16-year-old, almost 17-year-old back then when he committed those crimes?
Oh, how stupid he was, how misled he was by, you know, older friends that, you know, had befriended him, that, you know, made him think it was cool to have guns. He hates guns now. that committing crimes somehow made you this, you know, maverick, this you know, renegade. It gives you this kind of identity. I think that he has so many things to say to that 16-year-old boy who did this crime.
Mm-hmm. Did you talk about the details of that day, the crime?
Yeah, he did. And one of the details that I learned that I love so much and I never would have known if I hadn't sat down and talked with him is this. So Nancy is like the chatty Kathy. And Richard was the strong, silent type. And if you were together in a room with them, she'd be, you know, chattering on, and he'd be kind of, you know, beaming at her, you know, silently thinking, you know, isn't she, you know, cute and charming and everything. And so I imagined that when they came face to face with whoever had killed them, that she would have been the one trying to do the talking their way out of it. But David Bureau told me, it was the exact opposite, that from the moment Richard Langert saw a gun pointed at his wife and baby, that he'd never stopped trying to find ways, suggest ways that they could be let go, that they could live, and that he would stay behind and be killed himself rather than, you know, see them killed.
What did that mean to you to know what the last moments were really like for your sister and brother-in-law?
Oh, that's such a wonderful question. It meant everything to me because I had imagined that the last moments of her life were like a horror movie, just of fear, pain, misery, horror. And to know that she was surrounded by that love at the last, I mean, she was too weak to go for help. I mean, Richard died instantly from his wounds, but she lived on the corner, said, for about 10 minutes. And in that 10 minutes, first she tried to bang on this shelf down in the basement, trying to make a noise that someone might hear and come and help them. And I think when she realized that no help was coming and that she was dying, she dragged herself over to where Richard's body was, and she dipped her finger in her own blood, and she drew the shape of a heart and the letter U and wrote it on the floor next to him where he lay, "Love you." And we didn't know that detail about the crime scene until about a week after the police called and told my mother.
Jean, we have to take a break. What a story you have. Please stay with us. Jean Bishop, the author of Change of Heart, Justice, Mercy, and Making Peace with My Sister's Killer, tells her very personal story of restorative justice. She's an activist now. She's also a criminal defense attorney. We'll be back in just a moment with Jean Bishop sharing her personal story and her larger activism on behalf of restorative justice. Find out what it is when we come back. Jean Bishop, thanks for being with us. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. We're back with another edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Jean Bishop is my guest this hour. Author of Change of Heart, Justice, Mercy, and Making Peace with My Sister's Killer. In 1990, Jean's sister, Nancy, pregnant at the time, and brother-in-law, Richard, were murdered at their home in the Chicago suburb of Winnetka. After a long investigation, turned out a high school student, a local high school student, was the murderer. David Bureau, sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. And Jean took the step of writing to him and started a relationship with David in prison. Jean, take it from there. You developed this relationship with David in prison. Tie that in to the path you found to becoming an activist working for restorative justice.
Right. Restorative justice was a completely foreign concept to me, you know, when I started this whole journey. And, you know, what it is...
Even though you were a criminal defense attorney.
Right. Because, you know, we don't have any restorative justice. Well, we actually do now. We just, in Cook County, Illinois, where I'm a public defender, we just started a restorative justice court for juveniles in one section of the city. But other than that, you know, if there was a crime, the solution was place the person under arrest, charge them with a crime. They face either jail time or some kind of probation if it's eligible for probation. And there wasn't any opportunity to sit down with the offender, with the victim, with the community, with the victim's family, the offender's family, in this kind of larger circle to try to figure out, you know, what can be done. And there's, you know, so when I reached out to him to do this kind of seat of the pants restorative justice that I'm doing, you know, it wasn't with the help of any facilitator or any program or anything. And it made me realize that there was such healing there in that for me and for him.
Mm-hmm. So you didn't have any guides here. You just sort of went by what you felt you should do to help yourself, or were you also focused on him?
Oh, for sure, also focused on him. I mean, I think that, you know, it's what I've gotten out of the meetings with him is the ability to have this one-on-one victim impact statement that I never got to make at trial because it was a mandatory sentence. There was no aggravation and mitigation proceedings where I could say to him, here's what your crime did to my mother, to my father, to everyone who loved Nancy and Richard, her friends, her coworkers, you know, students she went to school with, her neighbors. I mean,
you told him that just in these prison visits. What was his reaction when he heard the details of the pain that he had caused?
You know, when it's a sunny day and then a cloud passes in front of the sun and everything goes a shade darker, that's what happens to his face when he hears things like this because he realizes the enormity of what he took. I mean, it was a stranger that he shot in the dark. There was no connection to all these people who love them and this kind of pebble that he dropped into a pond and sent out these ripples of evil and pain and heartache. He told me the other day that, you know, he said, the more I get to know you and your sister and brother-in-law through you, the worse I feel about what I did. Because now it's not just some stranger that he wiped off the face of the earth. It's this good, generous, life-loving, happy, open-hearted person that Nancy was, that now the more stories he hears about her, the more he knows. So that's a good thing.
So in this personal case of restorative justice, what can he do to fulfill what restorative justice is all about, to repair the harm caused? I mean, what can be done, to use your words, in this case?
Yeah, that's such a great question because, you know, I've written about this in a law review article that the typical scenario of restorative justice is what I call painting the garage. So you have a teenage offender and he takes a can of spray paint and he graffitis your garage and you come out and you're, you know, mad because your garage has been defaced and he's arrested. But instead of him being sent to jail for that, what he does is he's wrapped around in this restorative justice program where he cleans up the graffiti, he repaints the garage, you kind of mentor him or he has part of a mentoring program. The whole community, you know, holds him accountable to not do something like this again. And, you know, everything's restored. You can't do that with a murder. He can't give me back Nancy and Richard, and not only the baby she was carrying, but all the cousins that my children should have right now that they don't because they're gone. So all he can do is grasp the enormity of what he took, show sincere remorse for it, and try to live as honorable a life as he can so that he can now do in this world all the good that they couldn't do. They're no longer here on this earth, but he can, in their memory and in their honor, try to live a life now not of evil but of goodness, of reaching out in goodness in every way that they no longer can.
Mm-hmm. And what in particular has he done to reach out and act in goodness?
Well, I think part of it, you know, is part of the problem is that the prison where he is, and this I think goes for prisons all over this country, is that there are so few opportunities given to him to show, you know, ways that he's sorry and to express that. I mean, he can follow the rules. He can show respect and kindness to the inmates around him and the staff at the prison. But, you know, he started out, you know, as a high school student and was doing, you know, finished his degree and was doing some college courses. That was taken away, not from him, from everyone. He was playing music in a band. That was taken away. He was writing in this writing program, that was taken away. So, you know, there really is, you know, very limited ways that he can show, you know, his remorse and responsibility and regret. And that's one thing that I think we need to be better at, is to give people who are incarcerated more opportunities, even if they can't reach out to their own personal victims, even if those victims don't want to hear from them, to somehow, you know, be part of a restorative justice class so that they can, you know, meet with maybe other victims and say, this is the regret I feel over my crime.
Is there a chance that David, the killer of your sister, will ever be released?
There's almost no chance at all. And that's because of the that case I was telling you about, that where the Supreme Court said that you can no longer have mandatory sentences of life without parole. You're still allowed to have a discretionary sentence of life without parole. And he was given that sentence for killing the unborn baby because Nancy and Richard told him that she was pregnant, and he, you know, shot her in the stomach anyway. And the court found that because that was exceptionally heinous and cruel, that he deserved a life sentence for that. And so that was a decision the judge made. It wasn't a mandatory sentence. So no matter what happens on the other sentence, he will have to serve that out unless there's some sort of clemency from the governor.
Mm-hmm. So there is that possibility. I just wonder, I mean, I have to believe there's some people listening, and I'm sure you've encountered this question before. How do you know he's authentic, that he's not just playing you? You are a criminal defense attorney. Even if there's the slightest glimmer of a hope that he could be released, it would be through this action. How do you know his intent, his heart?
Yeah, that's a really legitimate question. And there's a number of ways that I know. Number one, I was a corporate attorney at a big fancy law firm when Nancy and Richard were killed. And when she died at the age of 25, I had a stark reminder of how short life is and that you can't do anything just for money or pride. You have to do what's deeply meaningful and what matters in the world. And so that's when I became a public defender. And over all the 28 years of being a public defender, I've heard every story from every manipulative, you know, client who's kind of trying to play me, as you said. And I've developed a really good BS detector. Mm. So that's one. Two, if he were really trying to play me, he'd kind of tell me things that I want to hear. And he hasn't always said those things. For instance, one of the things I've said to him is that, you know, he had taken the stand and tried to blame the crime on someone else. And I said, you know, you need to apologize to that person, too. And he didn't understand that. He said, well, the jury didn't believe me. So, you know, I mean, nothing really happened to him. I said, but it could have. He could have done the life sentence that you're now doing, an innocent man. And it caused great distress to his family. I mean, his mother actually reached out to my mother, just, you know, horrified that her son had been accused of this crime. You know, if he's trying to manipulate me, he's doing a really bad job of it, I guess. Hmm. And third, he's never once asked me to do anything for him. I know so many prisoners that find someone in the outside world that they kind of milk for money or visits or, you know, things being sent to them or some to head up some advocacy to get them out. He's never asked me to do anything, never asked me to advocate for him on his case, never asked me to give him anything. What he seems to be interested in, I think, most of all, is just that chance to have me as a friend instead of an enemy.
Mm-hmm. If you just joined us on this edition of River to River, Jean Bishop is my guest. Her book is titled Change of Heart, Justice, Mercy, and Making Peace with My Sister's Killer. Her sister was murdered along with her brother-in-law, her sister's unborn baby also killed at a home in Winnetka, Chicago suburb. And talking about her path to restorative justice, she's an activist in that area as a criminal defense attorney. I wonder what your family, all of those in the circle that loved your sister and Richard, your brother-in-law, what they think of your reaching out to this killer. And then I imagine there must be a mix of reactions.
Oh, right. I mean, I write about this in my book. When I first turned in my manuscript to the editor, he handed it back to me and said, you haven't talked about what this cost you. And it did, you know, cost me. There are people, you know, who support my decision. And, you know, then I know that for instance, my older sister, who's very angry at David Bureau and wants him to die in prison, you know, was deeply, you know, unhappy with my decision. And,
what made her most unhappy about it?
Oh, she doesn't want to accept that he could change. She doesn't want it disrupts her narrative that he's this remorseless monster. For him to show remorse, for him to express it, she can't accept that. And so it was very difficult for her. And so what we had to do as a family is just to say, you know, we've already lost one sister. Like, we can't lose each other. Our love for each other as family has got to overcome everything, including this, because this is a path of faith and conscience that led me, you know, to the place where I am now. And so that's where we are. You know, my sister and I live only about a mile and a half apart. We see each other on holidays and, you know, birthdays and all those things. Our kids know that, you know, we love each other, and no one has to break up as a family or take sides. We're not going to do that.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about why you're in Iowa. Iowa, of course, has some news in the last few years, new law about juvenile sentencing. There was a law revising how juveniles who commit first-degree murder are sentenced. In fact, earlier this year, we had a Supreme Court decision addressing this new law, moving toward less stringent sentences for juveniles. Does that have anything to do with why you're in Iowa at Drake University's legal clinic?
Yes, partly. Yeah, juvenile sentences, part of it. Part of it, too, is the fact that it seems like, you know, every year recently there's been some, you know, talk of trying to reinstate the death penalty. And, you know, at the time that Nancy's killer was sentenced and people said, aren't you disappointed he couldn't get the death penalty? That was the first chance I got to say, no, I'm relieved he couldn't get the death penalty. That shedding more blood and digging another grave and creating another grieving family would not heal me in any way, but wouldn't honor Nancy's memory. It would actually dishonor who she was. She loved life.
But that's maybe just specific to you. Others, it might be the path, right? Or not? Is that the path for everyone?
Oh, about the death penalty? Oh, no. Yeah. I make it a point to say I'm never speaking for anyone, all of people. I'm not speaking for all victims. Mm-hmm. But what I find normally is actually on the other side, that when prosecutors or pro-death penalty people are asked to justify why they support the death penalty, since it's more expensive than life, it doesn't deter crime, it risks killing the innocent, what they usually say is, well, the victims need it for closure. And kind of speak for all victims, assuming that we all want the harshest possible punishment, when that, in fact, is not true. And so our experience in Illinois of abolishing the death penalty in 2011, you all abolished it way back in 1965. Mm-hmm. Ours was abolished in 2011. And our Republican governor, Bruce Rauner, kind of floated the idea of reinstating the death penalty. And it was shot down from all sides, conservatives and progressives, all against this idea, because when you have a death penalty, it's not just, okay, now we're going to add this to our sentencing. It involves an incredible amount of resources, of money, to have a death row, to have the kind of appeals that you have to have on a death case, to have the specialized training and litigation resources. I mean, all of these things that go into having the apparatus of this killing machine that you want to, you know, reinstate. And so Illinois definitely rejected that, and I think that Iowans are sensible enough to reject it as well.
Mm-hmm. The country at large, though, going back a couple hundred years, we have this divide in this country in terms of what we do with people, how we punish punish people who commit crimes. Should they be rehabilitated? Should they simply be punished? Those are the two strains here that we have, that we struggle with also in our politics, right?
Right. And that's why, you know, I kind of believe in both and. I mean, you know, I'm not advocating for David Bureau to get out of prison, certainly not now, because he's served only 28 years, and I think that's an inadequate amount of time for taking three human lives. But at the same time, I also do think that because he is a human being with potential and worth, that you can't just deny him, you know, and other prisoners every opportunity to show their, you know, human potential through educational programs, through, you know, counseling through all the other opportunities you can have. So I kind of believe in punishment and rehabilitation. Mm-hmm. And the idea is this, that we're not going to throw people away forever, that we are going to find a way, we hope, if we can, to bring them back.
Are mandatory sentences ever in order in your mind?
No. And I'll tell you why. Because people are as individual and crimes are as individual as a fingerprint. And when you have this cookie cutter approach, you ignore the thing that really you have to look at to do true justice, which is who is this person? How did he get here? What happened to him? What brought him to this point? What unfolded in this crime? And what is the best way to address it? And I strongly advocate to, you know, returning discretion where it belongs, which is to individual judges. I find, you know, the judges and the prosecutors I work with, I absolutely trust them to make the right decision when they have all the information in front of them.
You just said that you're not advocating now for the release of the killer of your sister and brother-in-law, but I wonder, what are the criteria you would use for not just David Biro, but other similar situations, life in prison? Is there a list of criteria you could go through?
Oh, that's a great question. Remember when President Obama was running for president the first time in 2008? And he was one of the few people who had voted against the Iraq War. And he had voted against that war because he said he didn't disfavor all wars. He just disfavored stupid wars. And so when he became president, he had then, of course, to preside over the unwinding of that war. And he said, we need to be as careful getting out of that war as we were careless getting in. And that's kind of how I feel about these juvenile life sentences, that we were so careless and reckless in the way we handed them out, just mandatory. Boom. If you did this crime, boom, you get this sentence. And no individual look at you of how did you come to this point? Who are you? And, you know, not keeping track of anything or doing anything really for them while they were in prison. And now we have to unwind those sentences and we have to go back and we have to reconstruct who was this 16-year-old boy and who did he become in prison and what is he now? And that's the careful things that we have to do before we, you know, release people.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if you've looked into how our country, we were unique in so many ways compared to other countries in the world, but in this specific case, in the way we choose to punish and or rehabilitate those who commit crimes, are we where on the spectrum? Do you have a feeling for that?
I don't think most Americans realize what outliers we are. We're the only country in the world that sentences juveniles to life in prison, the only one. We are the only civilized Western democracy that has a death penalty left. We are in the company of China and Iran and places like that that we don't like to think that we're really like. So it's very, you know, unusual that a country like ours with the values we profess to have has still a death penalty.
Mm-hmm. How did we get here, do you think?
You know, I think we got here through this misguided version of an eye for an eye, that, you know, somehow that if you take a human life, we're going to take yours, and that will somehow represent the justice. I'm working on a second book now about the Oklahoma City bombing because its 25th anniversary is coming up in 2020. And I know very well the dad of one of the victims, Bud Welch, and the dad of the perpetrator. His name is Bill McVeigh, the father of Timothy McVeigh. Mm-hmm. And Timothy McVeigh, before he was executed for killing 168 people, said, the death penalty is an oxymoron, really, because it's not a penalty for me. It's an escape. He said that the government thinks that I'm this trophy. They've got me. They've won. He said, in the crudest terms, 168-1, meaning if your math is, you know, this is how we equal the score, this is how we do justice, I'm ahead of you by 167 people when you kill me. So he withdrew his appeals. He wanted to die. He didn't want to rot in prison and be, you know, forgotten or, you know, kind of discredited as history has rolled on. Mm-hmm. And so we handed him that victory that we wanted. And I think that death penalty is not a punishment. You can't punish someone that you've exterminated.
Jean Bishop, we've run out of time. A fascinating hour. Thank you for sharing a path you didn't choose, but one that you are on as an activist. Author of Change of Heart, Justice, Mercy, and Making Peace with My Sister's Killer. Jean, we appreciate you coming into our Des Moines studio.
It was such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Caitlin Harrop. Help today also from Alyssa Bavinet. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.